Diga Naka Sutta, Majjhima 74, Long Nails. Should be clipped. No long nails here. It was the hardest thing for me. Shaving my head was easy. Cutting my nails was hard. Like guitar playing nails.
Why? Because they're
struggling. Because playing guitar, you have long nails.
Oh, I didn't hear that.
Cutting my hair.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. So, Eva Mesutang. So this one, the Diga Naka, here's the correspondences. So, as we see, quite a lot, yeah? So, in the Sanyukta Agama, possibly in the Vedana Sanyukta, I would guess, in the shorter Sanyukta Agama, these are that's an independent sutra. That means it's just floating around somewhere. This one, well, when I say somewhere, I mean in the Taishō canon, but not part of an agama. These two are part of Vinayas, I believe. 25 and 27. They're part of a Vinaya. Is that Mula Sarvasivada? Dar something. Isn't there one with Burn in it?
And monks who came, we told them what we do with all these sutras.
Yeah.
And they were drooling what the young one was. He thought it was the most extraordinary way to learn sutras.
Yeah.
You've got to ring them up, don't you?
Yeah.
You
so,
keep saying you will.
I will, yeah, no, that's good. Keep reminding me. Okay, and this is from the... This is two from... all these Sanskrit ones as well. Two from the Avadana Shataka. Avadana is like a Jataka story. So Avadana is basically... but usually a Jataka story of the past lives of the disciples rather than that of the Buddha. So Shataka is 100. Okay, so this is like it's like a Jataka collection, a very well known Sanskrit Jataka collection, Avadana Shataka. I think if I'm not wrong, the Avadanas are taught by Upagupta in that to King Ashoka. And so these are Sanskrit fragments that's been partially reconstructed. This is another Sanskrit fragment from where? It doesn't say. Another Sanskrit fragment, so it's probably bits and pieces. Now there's also, he doesn't mention that here, but there's a Sogdian, there's two Tibetan ones, there you go, in the Gampo, and in the Mulasavasivada Vinaya. Now there's also a Sogdian, I'm not sure why that's not there, but Analia mentions it, which has been translated actually, a long time ago, Parivrajika. Okay, so it's in the Parivrajika Sutra of the Sanyukta Agama. Okay, Parivrajika Sutra, Sanyukta. Yeah. Maybe this is the Sogdian one. It's an Iranian language. So I've got an Iranian fragment as well. So. Quite. Yeah. Yep. So quite well represented. And we have blah, 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 blah. He doesn't mention all of the... they must have found the other parallels subsequent to writing this essay. So for those of you who may be new or not sure what these are, these essays which I use for these comparative studies are written by my friend Venerable Analio, who's a German monk, and he's been working through the whole Majjhima. He's actually finished the Majjhima now, and doing a big book on comparative studies of all the suttas in the Majjhima. And in the process of doing that, he's been using the already established parallels to these, but also researching and finding new parallels and also assimilating the information. So actually the information we have here on Sutta Central was put together by Analio together with Rod Bucknell. Okay, so they've been the main people putting together all this information we have here.
Rod's in Queensland.
Rod's in Queensland, yeah. So this is a project that I started together with Rod about 4 years ago now. And so Analio and Rod have been doing the main information, as you can see, very detailed and excellent information here. And now the site is very good because now you have the correspondences and the translations in different languages. So for the Diga Naka, we have the English translation and the German translation. There you go. As well as all the correspondences and the original Pali text. Liganaka to long nails.
Long nails.
And the German translation.
I guess because.
There should be a K. There should be an H. Yeah, that's misspelling. Yeah.
Does it say anywhere why?
It's curious why he hasn't put it there. It definitely should have. Sorry.
Does it say anywhere why he was called that?
I don't think so. But look, it may maybe on the Pali dictionary proper names, it might say. Paribhajika, nephew of Sariputta. There you go, sister's son. Visited Buddha, blah blah blah, Liganaka Sutta, Liganaka Sotapanna, and Sutta's address is Agivesana. He's originally an annihilationist. That's questionable, but he's the heretic Brahmin nephew of Sariputta, who was admonished by Moggallana because he expressed great repugnance at the sight of Kassapa. That's interesting.
Well connected.
Doesn't say why he's called Long Nail. Possibly he had long nails.
And then he's called Agivesana.
Agivesana is a clan name. Yeah, so that's like a surname. Yeah. Rather than a personal name. Okay. It could be, yeah. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in Rajagaha, Gijakuta, in the Gijakuta. The Vulture's Peak.
Okay.
I've been there, yes. Sukara Kataya. Sukara is a pig. Kataya. That's an unusual word. So they translate cave, but normally it's guha, or lena is a cave. Interesting. Anyway, that's supposedly identified in the Vulture's Peak, and whether it's the same cave or not, but there's actually not that many caves up there. But there is a little, it's not very, it's about half the size of the Far Cave, something like that?
Maybe.
Less than that?
The Vulture's Peak?
Yeah.
Yep. It's on the way out, on your right.
No, the cave, the boar's cave.
The cave.
There's the peak bit, and then it's on the way up is what they call the boar cave.
Got a little stuff in there now.
Yeah, you know, shrine and stuff. Yeah. But yeah, it's not much. You can't stand up in it. So it's pretty. So apparently Sariputta was staying there, it seems to be. Anyway, then Diganaka the Paribhajika, although here it says that the Buddha was staying there. Diganaka the Paribhajika, Paribhajika being a wanderer from another sect. And I went to the Blessed One, exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he stood to one side, like bhikkhunis and devas. Kind of interesting, he would have bumped his head if he was really standing in the boar's cave. And said to the Blessed One, Master Gotama, my doctrine and view is this, nothing is acceptable to me. Sabbang me nakamati. In the suttas, people usually sit down to one side, but for some reason the devas and the bhikkhunis
stand
to one side. And Diganaka for some reason. Never sure exactly why that difference is there.
Sometimes the Shalanga people do that too. They stand
yeah. So the setting of it is that Sariputta, it's just after Sariputta's ordination, so it's still very early in the dispensation. Now, what is Diganaka's view? Bhikkhu Bodhi's note here says that the commentary says that Diganaka is an annihilationist, Uccedavadin, and explains this assertion to mean no mode of rebirth is acceptable to me. However, the text itself does not give any concrete evidence supporting this interpretation. It seems much more likely that Diganaka's statement, nothing is acceptable to me, is intended to apply specifically to other philosophical views, and thus shows Diganaka to be a radical skeptic of the class satirically categorized at Majjhima Nikaya 76.30 as eel wrigglers. Mm-hmm. His assertion would then be tantamount to a wholesale repudiation of all philosophical views. And that perhaps gains some plausibility when we remember that as Sariputta's nephew, remember that Sariputta had just gone forth from the assembly of Sanjaya, who was the eel rigger par excellence. Right? So, Sanjayabhulatiputta. Anyway, Analia has some comments on that. What is Diganaka this more? Diganaka, blah, 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 view, additional background on these things. Mahaprajna Paramita Shastra, Mahavibhasha, and Avadana collections, blah, blah, blah. Additional background. Diganaka had been displeased or even irritated on hearing that his close relative Sariputta, who was respected for his intelligence, had become a disciple of another teacher. This would explain the slightly provocative nuance evident in the way he presented his view to the Buddha. Fair enough. The Diganaka sort of reports him to have held the view, I do not approve of anything. Okay, I do not accept anything. Kamati, it's the same root as the word kanti, as in patience, but here it's used as commonly used to mean to accept something, and in particular to be able to accept a belief or a view or an idea. Okay, it's very important that you remember that, because this meaning of kanti is very common. It's used both in Buddhist context and non-Buddhist context we have here, and yet it's for some reason it seems to have almost disappeared from the tradition, so that people regularly translate kanti in many contexts as meaning patient endurance, yeah, which it doesn't actually mean. I mean, it's one of its meanings, but in many cases it doesn't mean that. And that's particularly prevalent right throughout the whole Chinese tradition. They have these stages of the bodhisattva and so on, and one of them is the acceptance of a certain level of understanding, and what it actually means is the acceptance and understanding of a particular level of development of wisdom. But it's always translated as if to mean endurance of or patience of, and you see this translation doesn't make sense. Okay, so it's important to note. Exactly, yeah. Acceptance is a nice rendering for that reason, yeah.
How do you spell it?
Kanti.
K-H-A-N-T-I.
Yeah, is the noun form, and here is in a verbal. It's the verb form is kamati.
What's that word? The something
jhana
kanti, or is it?
Yeah. Kanti. Yeah, acceptance of
what
a view.
What translation would you give for the word kanti?
I think you can use acceptance pretty broadly for it. Yeah, it's not so specific, but in the Vata Parimokkha, patience is good. Yeah, but it also has the other word, titika, which is more specifically meaning like patient endurance. Yeah, so in that context it's emphasized. Yeah. Sabbang me na kamati. Okay?
Nothing is acceptable to me.
Nothing is acceptable to me. So I think that's good.
This states his position very clearly.
Yeah, and it's also used in the classic idiom. And let's see if it's in here. No, it doesn't say here. The classic idiom where you say, how are you, right? So to say, how are you in Pali,
yeah.
One of the things you say is kamaniyang, okay? Which means, are things acceptable to you? Yeah, are you bearing up to things? Yeah, are you all right? Yeah? So it's kamaniyang. Right. So, blah, blah, blah. Here we have, I do not approve of anything. Now, according to the two Chinese versions, his proposal was, I do not approve of any view. Or, in regard to all dhammas, I do not approve of any. So here, dhamma, again, meaning teaching, again, yeah. So while the version of Diganaka's proposal found in the Sanskrit fragment, Mahavibhasha, and the Sanskrit Avadhana Shataka, here we go, here's his nails, missed this bit. According to Mahaprajna Paramita Sutra, Mahavibhasha is, okay. Mahaprajna Paramita Shastra is a long and detailed commentary on the Mahaprajna Paramita Sutra, Mahayana Sutra, which was the foundational text, philosophical text in Chinese Buddhism, okay, and is attributed to Nagarjuna, whether it was actually written by him or not, interestingly enough, not found in Tibetan. Mahavibhasha is the commentary by the Sarvastivadins on their Abhidhamma, especially a book called the Jnana Prasthana. So this again is the definitive work. So like the way the Visuddhimagga is, for example, for the Theravadan school, these books are for the Madhyamaka school and for the Sarvastivadin school, respectively. Okay, so these all contain versions of this story. So according to these sources, he was called Diganaka because he did not cut his fingernails. And Pali commentary suggests that Diganaka was an annihilationist. And his proclamation implied that he did not approve any kind of rebirth. According to one of the Sangita argument discourses, his refusal first of views or doctrines, this much seems to also implicit in the reply the Buddha gave to this proclamation, since, anyway, we'll ask what his reply is, but notice that that analia on the basis of comparative study has confirmed what Bhikkhu Bodhi suggested in his note. Okay, so Bhikkhu Bodhi, just on the basis of internal coherence of the sutta, made the same suggestion. Okay, and in that case, Analeo has confirmed that by his comparative studies.
So the Pali commentary, if I'm saying that it's about rebirth, that's not.
It seems to be not the case, yeah. Yeah, it's about views. Yeah. Okay. Then the Buddha replies, this view of yours, Agivesana, nothing is acceptable to me, is not at least that view acceptable to you. Okay? Yeah, because it's a ditti. So you have this ditti. So here we see the way that the word ditti is used in the suttas, I mean a view, something, an opinion. Sabbangme na kamati. Is not at least this view. Api, pi. Even, or at least, that view. Isn't that at least acceptable to you? Okay, and then, so a very witty and direct reply by the Buddha. If this view were of mine were acceptable to me, Master Gautama, it too would be the same, it too would be the same. Tampasa tadi sanyeva. Tampasa tadi sameva. Okay.
Is Agivesana his official first name?
It's his surname, his family name. So, just like he's referring to the Buddha as Gautama, he's using his surname. So
he's Mrs. Agivesana's little boy.
That's right, yeah. So, obviously his reply lacking a certain degree of coherence there. He seems to be been a bit caught off guard there. While according to the Pali version, the Diganaka replied that it would not matter even if he were to approve of his view. Sangyukta Agama versions, Mahaprajna Bhita Sasa and Sasuke Avadana Shataka reforming, affirming that he also did not approve of his own view. Okay. This view I also do not approve of. Okay. Esapi me ko bho Gautama, Gautama. Even this good Gautama, my me drishtir. Drishtir nakshamate. Okay, so even that view is not acceptable to me. A bit more honest, isn't he? It's very consistent. So we've got two responses. And according to the Mahavibhasha, however, realizing his self-contradictory position, he remained silent. Okay, so this is reminding us a little bit of Jesus on the cross, that we have four different versions of it, and every one he says something different. So here we have three different versions of Diganaka's response, and every one he says something different. So anyway, I think that the conclusion that he's a bit discomforted and didn't manage to give a coherent response is probably fair enough kind of inference. Okay. And in two of the Samyukta versions, they say, why, if he didn't approve of his view, of his own view, did he proclaim it? And if he didn't approve of his own view, he might as well discard it, which seems logical enough.
Maybe it was just a sort of a smart-assy thing to say.
You see, wanted to challenge him. Well, Agivesana, there are plenty in the world who say it too would be the same, it too would be the same, yet they do not abandon that view and they take up still some other view. And there are few in the world who say it too would be the same, it too would be the same, and who abandon that view and who do not take up some other view. And that's a very, very lovely argument there, showing that you can have the position, oh, I'm not going to take up any views, I don't have any opinions, yeah? And so there are a lot of people who go around saying, oh, I don't have any views, I don't have any opinions, blah, blah, blah. Of course they do, yeah? And it's actually just an act of denial, yeah? And so that to really be able to relinquish views is a different thing altogether. So that's quite a nice analysis of that. So I give Esana. There are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this: everything is acceptable to me. Okay. Sabbang. Okay, where are we now? Sabbang me kamati. Everything is acceptable to me. Right. So this is the ones who go like, oh, all religions are the same in the end. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We are all brothers. God is Buddha. Buddha is God. God is love.
Love is
Buddha. Yeah? Everything. You are right. I am right.
You are right.
Everybody is right.
You can tell the sick story?
That's a bit sick. Yeah. The problem with that story is that I can't tell the whole story in its glory in polite company. But, even in impolite company too much. But, anyway, so I think we know what that is. And so, you know, you have this thing which is like it's a very affirming view, yeah? So we affirm everything. I affirm everything, right? And that's kind of course, very emotionally positive and can be very inspiring, yeah? But in the end, it kind of lacks a bit of substance, doesn't it? Because you can't actually... And in a sense, it's one of the problems with it is that it doesn't do any view justice because you've decided beforehand that you're going to accept everything. So you can't really understand it. Yeah, you don't really understand what does it mean because you've already decided that you're going to accept it. Well, yeah, but then that's just your kind of narrow framework and yeah. Okay, so that's that one. And there are also some who say everything is not acceptable to me. Okay, so this is a very kind of cynical worldview. They're kind of dismissing everything. It's all meaningless. Nothing has any point. Nothing's true. Blah blah blah. And then there are some who have the view, some things are acceptable to me and some are not acceptable to me. Okay? So it's taking a more discriminating stance. Okay? Now, therein, Akivesana, those samanas and brahmins, so this, of course, being a shorthand for saying like philosophers or thinkers, yeah? I say this, have this doctrine, this vada. And this ditti, again seeing the way that ditti is used, meaning a view or an opinion. Evang vadi, evang ditti, sabbang me kamati. Now that view of theirs, sa aragaya santike, is close to passions, close to holding on to. San yogaya santike, close to fetters. Abhinandanaya santike, close to, again, it's just a kind of synonym for delighting in something or relishing something, close to holding on to, close to grasping. And those who have the view, everything is not acceptable to me, that view is close to letting go, close to being unfettered, close to being not relishing and not grasping and so on. Okay?
So indeed, the nothing is acceptable to me is the best one.
Well, that's what Diganaka said. When that was said, Diganaka said to the Blessed One, the Blessed One praises my view. Yeah, and he exalts my view. Okay? And here the word dittigatang is used often. Dittigatang is usually used in a negative sense, meaning that like like literally means like it has kind of the implication of being like stuck in views, but here is just meaning his view or his theoretical system. And the Buddha, it seems to just ignore him at that point. It goes on. There in Agivesana, those Samanas and Brahmas who have this view and opinion, some is acceptable, some is not acceptable. Of those, yahite sang kamate sayang. Oh, those aspects of it which are the view of theirs as to what is acceptable is close to lust, close to bondage, and so on, and while the view of theirs as to what was not acceptable is close to non-lust, non-bondage, and non-clinging, and so on. Right. Okay, so you have a bit of both.
But he's still praising.
Yeah, there's that implication. Yeah, it's not explicit, but yeah. Now, Agivesana, a wise man among those recluses and Brahmins who hold the doctrine of view, everything acceptable to me, considers thus. If I obstinately adhere to my view, everything is acceptable to me, and declare only this is true, anything else is wrong. Okay, so this is the phrase we were talking about earlier with Yurik. Idameva satyam moghmanyam. Okay, so if I obstinately paramasa tamasa, if I stick onto and hold that tightly and insist on it, abhinivesa, only this is true, anything else is wrong, then I may clash with the two others. Some believes nothing is acceptable and some is acceptable, some is unacceptable. If I clash, when there's a clash, there's disputes. When there's disputes, there's quarrels. When there's quarrels, there is vexation. Thus, foreseeing for himself clashes, disputes, quarrels, and vexation, he abandons that view and does not take up some other view. This is how there comes to be the abandoning of these views. This is how there comes to be the relinquishing of these views. Okay? So it's talking about the abandoning and relinquishing of these views.
So,
what's
the
difference?
We haven't
got a read
to the end of it.
Yeah. So, sorry?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's a particular reason given here, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
That's a particular reason. And remember, it's being emphasized. What's being emphasized before is saying, you know, you stubbornly and belligerently insist that only this is true and everything else is stupid, okay? And so this is the kind of view you have to abandon. Okay. Now it's interesting that it's taking this response. I mean, in the suttas, you basically have two like complementary approaches. One is that you have to abandon wrong view and develop right view, right? And then the other perspective is you have to get beyond views altogether, right? So you've got these two kind of complementary approaches. Now this is at the moment anyway seeming to be taking that perspective that you have to get wrong beyond all views. Yeah. And it's kind of interesting that this is set shortly after the Buddha's awakening, and it's often felt that in terms of the development of teaching within the Buddha's lifetime, that earlier on, in the earlier period, that there was more emphasis on these kinds of teachings, and in the later period there was more emphasis on more straightforward of abandoning wrong view and developing right view. I'm not saying that that is the case, I'm simply saying that argument has been made on a number of occasions. And that it's interesting that there seems to be the case here so far, but we're not insisting that only that is true and everything else is false.
How do you know that this was said close to the awakening?
Because it's only 2 weeks after that Sariputta is not yet enlightened. Yeah, so Sariputta's just joined. So this is a little clue you can get. Yeah, it's not often that we get those clues.
Yeah.
So, and then similarly, he goes through the kind of the matrix, and in each case, if you hold stubbornly to any of those views, then you're going to argue and fight with the others. Okay. And even these words that we're finding, vivada and vikata, so on, vigaha, are characteristic of the Attikavagga and the Suttanipata, which is often regarded as one of the earliest strata of suttas. Yeah. Okay, so then he leaves aside the views. Okay, so we've gone through views, and he's basically he hasn't really solved the problem in a sense. He's just sort of said, well, listen, if you're going to get stuck on these things, you're going to get in a hassle. So he's not necessarily resolving it, but then he's pointing out another avenue of investigation. Yeah? Now, Agivesana, this body made of material form consisting of the four great elements, Mahabhutiko, Mata Pettika Sambhavo, procreated by a mother and father. And notice that in Pali, in compounds, the mother always appears before the father. And built up out of boiled rice and porridge. Udana and Kumasa, yeah. And, oh, I bet you're looking forward to chanting this one. Anichu chadana parimadana bedana vidang sanadammo. Is anyone... So, anicca, it's impermanent. The subject of impermanence being worn and rubbed away. Chadana parimadana. being rubbed away is the same word that's used for having a massage. Bedana, breaking up. One order dissolution and disintegration, vidangsana. Okay. Yeah, dhammo here meaning nature, having the nature of all those things. Vidangsana. Okay, and this body. Paragraph 9. It should be regarded as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, as a boil, as a barb, as a tumor, as a dart, as a calamity. Abhadhato, as a dart. Parato, it's alien. Yeah, as a calamity. Agato, yeah. Parato, alien. Palokato, you could say it a bit more clearly, as disintegrating, as void, sunyato, as not self, anattato samanapasitabo. Okay? So.
Wow, and then you say, may I be happy, love yourself.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and then when it's contemplated in that way, then your kayasmin kayachando, the attachment and so on for the body, kayachanda, the desire, sneha, cognate with unvayata, that's an interesting translation, unvayata, going along underneath it.
Unvayata.
Yeah, I think it means where your body's ruling your world. Yeah.
Like instead of reading the sutta, you're painting your toenails.
Something like that, yeah. Well, exactly, yeah. That's what Deganak has been doing. Sneha being cognate with what English words?
Snare.
Snare, no?
You've done this before.
You've done this before, exactly, yeah. But no, I'm not asking what it means. Oh, what it means. It's just a word. In this context, it's a word for desire. But cognate with what English words?
Snake.
No.
Don't know.
Snot. Snot and snow.
Snow. Snow.
What's in German?
Schnee.
Schnee. No, it's Schnee, I think, doesn't say much. Sorry? Snot. Snot? The stuff that comes out of your nose.
Snot.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound much like
Meha. Yeah, it means, the meaning is moisture. It comes from the meaning of moisture, yeah, but using the word of desire, like the waters of love, using English. Anyway, there you go. A little bit of a Pali quirk moment there. Moving right along. Okay. There are three kinds of feelings. So we started with the body, rupa kanda. Now we go to vedana, sukha, dukkha, adukkama sukha. On what on occasion you experience pleasant feeling, you do not feel painful or neither painful or pleasant. On one occasion you're feeling only pleasant. On occasion we feel painful, you don't feel pleasant or neither painful nor pleasant. You only feel painful. On occasion we feel neither painful nor pleasant, you don't feel pleasant or painful feeling on that occasion, you feel only neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Is that right? You only feel one kind of feeling at a time? Don't we usually feel complicated feelings? Yeah?
Well, you can have a sore knee and feel good in the shoulder.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? Yeah. Or you could be really upset and angry and feel really bad but be eating chocolate cake. Yeah. In fact, that's usually what we do, isn't it? Yeah, we try when we feel really bad and upset, then we want to go and eat chocolate cake or something like that. Well, something else then, if not chocolate cake.
Comfort food. But maybe we're only conscious of one sense at a time, and you're trying to replace the unpleasant feelings.
Yeah.
No, but I think it's possible.
I don't think.
What do you think?
Well, no, yeah, people have different kinds of things. I remember when I was in Nam, and I was staying in this kuti, and the owner of the land that the kuti was on was this lady who owned this silver factory, and her brother was the guy who used to come and look after me and stuff, and the brother came, oh yeah, the sister's come up, she's driving her new Mercedes. So, because in Thailand, you know, Mercedes are expensive everywhere, but in Thailand there's 100% import tax on any luxury car, right? So it's twice as much as it costs in Germany. So the next time you go to Bangkok and look at all the Benzes driving around,
yeah.
I think they all cost twice as much as anywhere else than in Germany anyway. And I'm like, oh, what does she need a new car for? She said, oh, she had an argument with her husband and she just really needed to go shopping to make herself feel good. Yeah, but it could also be, you know, you can still imagine that the Vedana, and even Vedana from the same base, you know, like, I've got a sore neck at the moment, so I've got pain there, but I could maybe, you know, drink a nice cup of coffee at the same time.
Mm.
So...
But I don't think you're conscious of both at the same time.
No.
Aren't you?
Like, you can pinch yourself when you're getting, your tooth healed or something. And
I learned that one on Gilligan's Island, actually. Because No, just by watching it, I wasn't actually there. No, because I remember one time, and Gilligan asks, Ginger was complaining about how much her shoes pinched her. I think Gilligan had to put on her Ginger's earrings or something like that. And he said, oh God, it's so painful. How do you endure the pain? She said, oh, it's not a problem. I just focus on how much my shoes are pinching my feet. So that's a good This is one of the first contemplative strategies that I learned. So I don't know. It's an interesting thing because it is a part of, you know, and it was in the Abhidhamma. Of course, it's made much more specific. Like you have a stream of mind moments, and in each one mind moment, you're only experiencing the one kind of feeling. But of course, you can have many mind moments in a stream, and they're mixed up. So what we're kind of conscious of is that stream, which is mixed up, but if we actually analyse it right down, we only experience one feeling at a time.
Yeah? Because that's how they do. They work so fast,
yeah?
And they still, unless you have two CPUs, one CPU can only give
so
one thing at a time, but they work
parallel
so fast.
Processing,
yeah.
And
that's,
you know?
It. Yeah.
It's like parallel and analog.
Yeah, but the CPU can't work.
So
we're
analog.
This is your call, okay?
Yeah. One CPU can't be.
What about quantum computers? But the human brain doesn't work like that, does it? I mean, it's much more complex. You've got kind of webs of neurons firing, and then you've got soups of chemicals, and you've got interaction.
Yeah.
Of all
no,
kind
say
of
the
things.
Abhidhamma kind of attitude. It's like, computer
it's like
attitude.
The attitude, yeah.
You can be multitask, but only in short periods that you
can. Yeah, exactly. It's binary, yeah.
Maybe we can ask Dania.
Yeah, okay, we'll do that when she recovers. Right. Anyway, there we go. What are we going? Present feeling is impermanent, conditioned, dependently rigid, subject to destruction, fading away, and ceasing. Painful feeling and unpainful, and neither painful nor pleasant feeling is the same. So, seeing thus, evam pasangagi sutva aryasavako sukhaya pi vednavi nibindati. So notice that phrasing here is very reminiscent of the Anattalakkhana Sutta, yeah? Dukkama sukhaya pi vednaya nibindati nibindang virajati viraga vimuchati vimutasming vimutamiti jnanam hoti kiya. So this is all very similar to the Anattalakkhana Sutta. Yeah. Sorry?
Fire Sama
has a similar ending, yeah. So this particular teaching, based on, you know, just notice the kind of the structure of the teaching. It's interesting that that, you know, the start of it, Diganaka's coming from a completely intellectual space. Yeah, he's coming from a philosophical, skeptical point of view. Yeah, so it's completely a conceptual thing. So the Buddha first of all points him to his body, and so we'll have a look at what the nature of your body is, and see that that's impermanent and so on and so forth. And it needs to be remarked that even though in this particular context the Buddha is pointing out the disadvantages of the body, of course there are many other places where the body is treated in a very positive light. So if you look at, and there's a very nice essay by Venerable Tanisaro on that, and there's basically a conscious development of two perspectives on seeing the body. So you know, for every passage where you see something like this, you'll also see a passage where the Buddha's talking about saturating your body with pleasure and bliss and so on and so forth in meditation. So it's not as if Buddhism has an exclusively negative aspect, but at those times when it's necessary to do it for this particular person, so obviously you're kind of pulling him out of his conceptual world, pulling him into his body and saying, let's have a look at that, the impermanence of that. So the Rupa Khanda and Vedana Khanda, the two that are focused on here. So again, you can see it relating to the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. So you can see this progression of teachings in the Dhammacakka Sutta. First Noble Truth, five khandas are suffering. Just says that. Doesn't even say what the five khandas are. In the second sutra, it explains what the five khandas are and deals with all of them to some detail. And now here, the Rupa Khanda and Vedana Khanda are being treated in more detail. So they're kind of being honed in on, focused in on. So this is like process where you're going further into the same teachings. Okay, so somebody with a mind released like that, then he doesn't sangvarati, sides with none. Yeah, right, sangvarati, sides with none. Vivarati, and disputes with none. So this is quite a nice linguistic usage here. Varati, literally to speak. Sangvarati, so speaking on the same side. Vivarati, speaking differently, speaking on a different side. Okay. He employs the speech currently used in the world without adhering to it. Yancha loke vutang tena voharati aparamasanti. Okay, again, a very important statement for Buddhist philosophy. And quite, and it's a very useful principle, yeah? But one which is not at all not unproblematic by any means, yeah? So you employ the usage used in the world, but sometimes that usage is inherently misleading. So the Buddha sometimes would also question the usage of the world, okay? So when the Jains would refer to not karma as action, they would refer to it as a punishment. So he said, no, I'm not referring to it as punishment, I'm referring to it as an action, yeah? And so he would change the usage. But as a general principle, to use the to go along with the world, but without aparamasan, adhering to it or misapprehending. Now this word also is very interesting, but the root of it is to hold something, okay? So to touch something or hold something or grasp something. But this, the prefix para in this kind of context has a strongly negative implication. It's an idiom. Doesn't mean that, but it has that implication. It's used in that way. Or pari, actually, it's not para, it's pari. So paribhasati, bhasati means to speak. Paribhasati means to abuse or revile. Yeah. So paramasang means to hold wrongly. So to misapprehend, we would say in English. Yeah. And so he is saying without misapprehending it. Okay. Or mistaking. Yeah. Again, the same roots in English. Yeah. To take something. Yeah. To hold on to it. Yeah. It's not without mistaking it.
What verse have you?
Oh, this is now 13.
Oh, that's only short.
That's really long. Okay. It's just, the mind has liberated that.
It's just that is bit. Also, just in the video, right? Okay, yeah. In the video, it talks about you're not allowed to adhere to your to language. So, like,
uh-huh.
If something is called a...
Yeah.
If something is called a pan...
Yep.
Here, but it's called a frying device somewhere.
Yeah,
else.
Well,
you
it's called
argue,
a
bat. You don't argue about it.
Yeah.
You just use whatever's
yeah.
appropriate at that place.
It's actually in the suttas. There's similar things in the Vinaya,
yeah.
But it's in the Arana Vibhanga Sutta. Arana Vibhanga Sutta. Yeah, it's exactly right. You know, so there's like a, you know, your bowl, and the exact example that he uses is a bowl. You know, like your monk's bowl, it's the most common thing. And in this country it's called that, and in that country it's called that, and in that country it's called that. So you just call it a bowl. Yeah? And it's interesting that monks exactly don't do that. So when they take the bowl into Thailand, they call it a baat, which they take from Sanskrit. And then, you know, even the Western monks, and you go and live in overseas and so on, you still call it a baat. It's sort of a bastardized Sanskrit version of something that's adopted from some Indic dialect, and the Buddha said, just call it whatever it's called in the local area. So, I mean, sometimes, of course, you do that because there isn't a word. Yeah? So if we don't have a word for samadhi, then we adopt that word and we use that. Yeah? So that's all right. But when you have a perfectly good word, then you just use whatever the local word is. Alright, so now on that occasion, Sariputta was standing behind the Blessed One, and it wasn't mentioned earlier, but presumably was there all along. Standing behind the Buddha, Pitito Tito Hoti Bijayamano, fanning him. And if you've been up in Rajagaha, you know why he's fanning him. Yeah. And then Venerable Sariputta said, then he thought, etadahosi, so this is the idiom to say you thought of something, thus it was, or this, no, sorry, not thus, this was, in other words, to say it occurred to him, this was. The Blessed One indeed speaks to us of the abandoning of these things through direct knowledge. The Sublime One indeed speaks to us of the relinquishing of these things through direct knowledge. As the Venerable Sariputta considered this, through not clinging, his mind was liberated from the taints. Now, that is a little bit problematic.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it is, unfortunately.
No.
So the Buddha spoke of abandoning that view and not holding on to it, Jackie. So. Okay. Okay. Oh, according to the Avadana account, when Diganaka remained silent at the beginning, a thunderbolt wielding spirit intervened and forced him to reply. That does tend to have a motivating influence. So the other ones are similar. Okay, so we should have mentioned this earlier. The Samyukta Agama versions do not bring in the mutually exclusive nature of the three types of feelings. Interesting, but they probably do elsewhere, but not in that particular case. So the actual wording's a little bit different, but all of them have the contemplation of feelings, but a little bit different. The Pali Discourse at the time reports the Buddha making a pronouncement on the type of speech used by an arahant, a pronouncement not found in the other versions. So again, that's quite interesting, isn't it? Yeah? And that thing about the, you know, speaking in accordance with worldly usage is not found. Now that particular question was certainly one that was debated among the early schools. Yeah? To what extent was the Buddha using accommodating worldly usage? And so it could be a sectarian piece there, yeah. That relates, of course, in the later Abhidhamma, you have this idea of conventional reality versus ultimate reality, okay? And that distinction is not found in the suttas, but statements like that, obviously, in some ways, were the precursor to it. Yeah. But notice that the Buddha doesn't say, you know, one speaks in terms of ultimate reality or conventional reality and ultimate reality. He's saying that all of our speech is conventional, yeah? So speech by its very nature is conventional. So the idea of ultimate reality in that sense is not part of the Buddha's teachings. Okay. Now, as Pali and Samyukta Agama discourses report that Sariputta, who had been present during this conversation, at this point reached full awakening, while Dihanaka became a stream enterer. Right. Fair enough, according to the Pali version, Sariputta became an arahant after reflecting that the Buddha's instruction aimed at abandonment through direct knowledge. The Samyukta Agama versions, Sanskrit's fragment and the Avadana Shataka present the same event more in terms of actual meditation. According to them, Sariputta became an arahant by practicing contemplation of impermanence and thereby developing dispassion. Okay, so was it just while listening to the Dhamma talk and reflecting on it, or was it through actually doing meditation? The Pali discourses have also preserved an account of the type of insight practice that led Sariputta to become an arahant. This account is found in the Anupada Sutta, a discourse apparently without a Chinese counterpart. So, according to this discourse, the insight practice undertaken by Sariputta was to analyze the mental constituents of the jhanas and the immaterial attainments and to develop detachment in regard to them through insight into their impermanent nature. Okay? Now, that particular sutta is obviously a late sutta, and Analia probably should have mentioned that there. And it's composed specifically in order to associate Sariputta with the development of the Abhidhamma. And the mental constituents here is actually an Abhidhamma style list. And it's one of the suttas in the Pali Canon which is most obviously a kind of a late compilation, proto-Abhidhammic compilation. Now, more details here about Sariputta's enlightenment here, which is also quite interesting. At first sight, the reference to Sariputta's destruction of the influxes through attaining the cessation of perception and feeling, right, which is what he said in the Anupada Sutta, may seem to stand in contrast with the unanimous report found in the Majjhima 74 and its parallels that Sariputta became an arahant while listening to the Buddha's instruction to Digha Naka. So we've got two things. Did he become an arahant by investigating the jhanas, as seems in the Anupada Sutta, or through listening to the discourse on the impermanence of feelings, as in the Digha Naka Sutta? An issue not without relevance in contemporary discourse, because this particular sutta, the Digha Naka, is relied heavily on. Notice Jen nodding there. Is that right? Relied heavily on by Goenka? Is that right? Is that true? That's what I've heard. Yeah, okay. Okay.
I did have a conversation with someone in Burma.
Yeah.
And they said, what's your practice? And I said, I've been contemplating a matter.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, that's just a bit conceptual.
Uh-huh.
I think what was an interesting thing to do because I wasn't actually meditating.
Yeah.
Unless I was watching all these mental practice.
Mental practice. Yeah.
Which is also a conceptual practice.
Yeah. yeah.
But, anyway.
That's odd.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's what I've heard. Now, whether it's a big deal in that tradition or not, even if you haven't heard of it, it probably isn't. But I have heard that this sutra is used by Goenka to say, oh, see, Sariputta became an arahant by contemplating feelings. And so to use that's a justification for their kind of weight in our contemplation practice. But just interesting to notice that there is that ambiguity in the tradition, because the other place it says clearly that he was done it by practicing the jhanas. And that the Anupada Sutta, where it says that he practiced jhanas, is clearly a late sutta, so that's fair enough. But in the Anguttara Nikaya, it records that Sariputta's development of higher insight was indeed by way of the Sukha Patipada Kipabhinya. Okay, and that's also the pleasant way of practice is explicitly defined as being the practice of the jhanas. So both of those sources imply that the jhanas are important. Of course, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. Now, obviously, you know, we can assume Sariputta was going off and doing his meditation and doing jhanas and things like that, and then he came and listened to the talk and it was at that time. So they're giving different accounts, which may or may not be contradictory, but they're certainly not necessarily contradictory.
And we have many other stories of people attaining arahantship in motion.
In motion.
Not
necessarily at the time of meditation, yeah, sure.
Yep. I would like to ask a question because
yep.
the meaning of meditation, may we make a definition, general definition about meditation, or different religion has a different definition?
No, define meditation. Anyone?
And what about like other religions? Because
uh-huh.
I talked to the Christian, we meditate, you have to have a subject to meditate about.
Yeah, yeah.
What I learned from Buddhism, to meditate is to cut off from the subject. How is in Muslim, how is in
In Buddhism, it's not necessarily that way. Actually, that particular point is an interesting one because it's actually okay. It's two kinds of things that you can do with your mind in meditation. One of those kinds of things is to basically just choose one object or one subject of meditation, like the breath or something like that, and then just pay attention to that. So this is what we normally mean in Buddhism when we talk about meditation. Okay, so that's the basic meaning. You're sitting down quietly, closing your eyes, you focus on the breath or maybe some other meditation, and just that one thing. And any thoughts that come into the mind, any ideas and so on and so on, you leave them aside. That's not part of the meditation. So that's one kind of thing you can do. Another kind of thing you can do is to take up a subject and then contemplate it. And we would, in Buddhist circles, we would usually call that a contemplation or a reflection. Okay, and both of them are good, and both of them are part of what we do in our meditation practice. In Christianity, and I learned this from a friend of mine who used to be a Christian monk. He said they have the same things, but they call them the opposite names. So in Christianity, a meditation is to reflect on a theme, which is what we call contemplation. Whereas contemplation for them is to just focus on one thing. So they might just focus on the compassion of Jesus or something like that. They're not thinking about it, but they're just experiencing it. Or just the name of Jesus or something like that. So they actually do that, although it's not so well known. You know, it's not so important within the Christian tradition, but it is there.
And another religion,
like
Hinduism?
Yes. Hinduism would be similar again. You know, they definitely have those two kinds of meditation within Hinduism. The Muslims, I'm not so sure. They do have a contemplative tradition in the Sufis, but I'm not sure exactly what style their meditation consists of. Yeah, it'd be interesting to look at that.
So, Judaism is going to be like Christianity?
Judaism? Jewish meditation?
They don't meditate.
No contemplative tradition? What about the Kabbalah and all these weird Jewish mystics and stuff? There's probably... Yeah.
I see very Orthodox Jews that they just sit in synagogue and they are so contemplated, you know,
Yeah. Intense prayer.
They pray.
Mm.
But they are completely cut off from the exterior world.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they pray. There's prayer that you have to do.
They're actually doing the prayer, yeah. So look, I mean, I would be surprised if there wasn't a Jewish mystical tradition. I mean, you've got the Gnostics and stuff,
the
Kabbalah and the Gnostics and stuff. So it's kind of like the left-hand tradition. I mean, it's the difference really in the Judeo-Christian and Muslim traditions is that thing's always a bit
on the left.
Yeah,
side.
It's the kind of the slightly hidden stream, and it has this kind of quite dubious relationship with the mainstream. Yeah.
Because
Which is not. I mean, you find the same thing in attitudes in Thailand and stuff as well. So. Yep.
So you're saying it's problematic that bit because it contradicts the other. So I always found that story inspiring because Sariputta is supposed to be so analytical, but according to that story, faith played a huge role. And then according to text critical studies, if you take the more the kind of the, if you're looking at the agenda, the later agenda would have been to emphasize this analytical bent.
Yeah.
And so even though that story only appears in the Pali in that one place, it seems like unlikely that it would have been inserted by.
The Diganaka story occurs in other places. It's the analytical one that doesn't occur elsewhere, only in the Pali.
Right. Right, but what did it say something about that in the Pali, it just says that it was just, he just thought about the knowledge was
Okay.
emphasizes his
meditation. More meditation, you're quite right, yeah.
I mean, it could be both.
That's difficult to say. I mean, in either case, you know, well, here we go. Here's the translation of the Chinese. He contemplated those dhammas as impermanent, contemplated their rising and ceasing, contemplated dispassion, contemplating total cessation, contemplating relinquishment, and so on and so forth. Upashino. So the Sanskrit fragment has anupashino. It's like a meditative contemplation. So, again, I mean, that's probably just a difference in wording there, but it's different. I mean, obviously, there must be an element of contemplation there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wonder if he kept on fanning the Buddha while he was becoming an arahant.
Mm.
That's why he wasn't doing jhana, because if he was doing jhana, he wanted to touch with his hands.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He also found the Buddha.
Yeah. Okay, so then just a brief note there that in the Pali version, Diganaka declared himself a lay follower, while the Chinese and Sanskrit versions he requested ordination and became an arahant, as do the Mahaprajna Paramita Shastra and the Avadana Shataka. And Alio's comments that this is more in line with what one would expect, since it's difficult to imagine that Dighanaka continued to live as a non-Buddhist wanderer after becoming a stream enterer, and it would be even more odd to assume that he reverted to lay life, so that for him to ordain as a Buddhist monk would be self-evident. So it seems fairly plausible.
So the Pali system would be off-key?
In that particular case, yeah. Northern traditions also know of another discourse of Dighanaka. Oh, that's why it's not something I mentioned. Okay. Another discourse of Dighanaka, a discourse extant in Chinese, Tibetan, and also Sogdian, an ancient Iranian language. That's why it's not listed as a parallel, because it's actually a different sutta. This discourse is a completely different. A Brahmin visitor inquired from the Buddha about the karmic causes for various physical qualities of the Buddha. And the Brahmin took refuge in the fact that beings are heirs to their karma.
So that might have been a different Dighanaka.
It's a different, quite possibly a different Dighanaka and a different sutta, yeah. Yeah, quite likely. Okay. Any more questions? Also the first five disciples as well. You know, he had to sort of persuade him that he really did know. He's very clever.
He's
got that wittiness, that kind of you see his personality coming through.
And when
he teaches the monks as well.
And when you bring that up, then it ties in nicely with the whole views thing, because it's like getting beyond views.
Yeah.
He's even learned than some monks as well.
All right. tip.